This is an Enterprise Time Security podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Mike Kaiser, who's Director of Strategy at SailPoint. Mike, hi.
I'm Director of Strategy and Standards. I help to develop the product strategy, both short and long term. And then the other half of my job is that I'm on several Internet Identity Standards working groups trying to make things work better.
Make things work better. Now, there's a phrase. Do you want to elaborate?
Sure. It's always an ideal and then a practical reality. Most of us in those working groups developing everything from SCIM to OAuth to whatever else are seeking truth. This is the way the internet or society with identity should work. It doesn't always work out like that because there are incentives in play as well. It's a fascinating mix of truth and practicality at the same time. Making things work better, I say it that way because it's a pretty low bar. I don't want to be overambitious about an ideal. Sometimes just better than what we had is still a step in the right direction.
Identity. We throw that word around continually in this industry, when really what we mean is, well, we've given you some credentials to do something. Credentials do not necessarily equal identity, in the same way that you can have a dozen avatars in a dozen different virtual worlds. None of them necessarily identifies you as a person. What is our hang-up with identity as an industry?
That's a broad question. As an industry, it's like anything that has technical aspects that interact with society. How you define terms are massively important, as you bring up with identity. Look at the current ideas around identity in society, and you can see some of the underpinnings of what's going on technically. Think back to the Romantics in central Germany, all about self-actualization and identification of the self. We're seeing that play out technically here now, too. There are some fascinating movements in play there. But usually when you say, oh, I'm an identity, well, you need someone to actually define that, what that means and what the context is before you can have a more rational discussion.
One of the reasons I ask that is if we go back 30 years, the idea of our identity to access a computer system was inexorably tied to who we were in that organization. Today, we live in a world where people are using online systems personally. They're using them professionally. They're operating in virtual worlds where some people are happy to be tracked across virtual worlds. Others want to be completely separated. The bottom line is that people have multiple identities as we perceive an identity. How do we craft something that from a standards and a legal perspective in a business can be seen to be a true identity of an individual and therefore what they do?
Or it gives them the capability of doing what they're allowed to do. That's a fascinating question because it's not just a representation of who that person is, but it's a representation of who that person is in relationship, in this case, relationship to an organization. So as you call out, they could be an individual, they could be an employee, they could be a vendor, they could be a partner. There are obligations that we have to humans, narrow the scope a little bit, to put it in its proper context and provide safeguards. For example, if I come to an organization and I'm an employee, if I'm also a customer of that organization, as an individual, I probably want my identities to stay separate from their perspective. I don't want my employer to know I'm also buying services and goods from my employer. I want those identities to be separate. The only time I want them to be unified or have a coherent view is from my perspective and my thing. Keeping that identification separate is really, really important from a privacy, from a governmental, from even a standards point of view. It's what we have in mind. Now, when that plays out into the actual enterprise sphere, incentives come back in. That may not always be the case. But putting up those safeguards and ensuring that you can carry those out is crucial.
We often think of identity as being that of an individual. But if we look at our Active Directory, or we look at any form of directory that we operate, physical human-breathing individuals make up an increasingly smaller percentage of the digital identities that we deal with. Machines, IoT, software, these things have swamped our identity systems. And they have different requirements, different needs. They bring different sets of data that don't fit within what we perceive. As you start to design products, as you talk about working with standards, how do we begin to separate out realistically what is a human identity from a machine or other generated identity, and how do we make our systems flexible enough that we can make that separation and run our businesses effectively?
There's a couple of things. One is you're not inventing concepts or approaches out of new whole cloth. At times, you can use past patterns to establish these kinds of identities. When we're talking about IoT or the Internet of Things or that whole spectrum of machine identities or non-human identities, it's a spectrum. Everywhere from the credentials or the access to a passive camera to RPA or bots that are automating processes, to pick your most recent movie where AI goes horribly wrong. It doesn't matter what example you want to use. I'm a little bit older, so sometimes I use Superman 3, but that reference is getting massively old. But the point is, there's a continuum rather than discrete buckets. Some of these things only need governance or management. For example, a passive device identity or a service account. That needs to be used, but more than anything else, it needs protection against illicit access. Whereas a bot or a robotic process automation, something like customer service chatbot or something that's doing an automated process, what you really want to do is treat it like a contractor, where if it goes, here's the hard line baseline, if it goes outside of this range, immediately shut it down, prevent it from doing things. On the far end of the spectrum, back to that evil or maybe benevolent AI, that's a lot more like a human. There's flexibility and there's rationality there. So you have to think about these past patterns that you might be able to apply that we already know how they work, rather than saying this is a whole new thing. That's one of the ways. Secondarily, your systems have to have concepts that can extend into these new realms. Identity is not new. Just because there are new attributes or new claims about identities doesn't mean it's fundamentally different than what came before. I can have firmware level, for example, on some device that I wouldn't have, hopefully, on my contractor that comes in every Thursday. But those attributes don't fundamentally change how I have those. The other key part is having authoritative sources for all those repositories of identity. How do you prove that this human actually exists, or this bot actually exists, or whatever else, that it actually exists and that it should exist? A lot of organizations, when I first started talking about some of this machine identity back in 2017, 2018, I would say, who's using robotic process automation or bots? And people would not raise their hand. Okay, how many of you have parts of your organization where they're innovating and they're writing automatic programs to do things? And of course, most of the room raised their hand. I was like, actually, you already have it. Let's talk about what the implications are. It's that kind of a thing.
How do we manage things like entitlements and security? If it's an individual coming in, or stolen credential, we are looking for what it's accessing. We are focused on what it can access, where it goes with that access, and what data it touches. I was interested in your comment about bots just now, because actually we don't tend to think of bots in that same way, or at least most of us don't, and certainly not when we talk about machine accounts, yet they all access data, very sensitive data, and we don't watch what they're accessing. So how do we take this phrase of entitlement, which seems to now be the replacement phrase for your right to access something, and work out where it should be applied, but more importantly, what has that entitlement?
A couple of thoughts here. One, machine accounts, if we're talking specifically about those, they're a means to an end. I don't really care usually that this machine account has accessed this resource. What I care, to your point, you alluded to it, is that someone has control of that machine account and they're accessing this. I want to know who the actual actor or the primary mover is, rather than just that it used this machine account. Entitlement? Yes, I would use a different term these days. I would switch from entitlement to something more like policy, which is a very, very umbrella term. But fundamentally, it just means, what do I know about this primary actor? What do I know about the resource they want to access? And then I need to decide, based off of all that information, some assessment of whether or not they should have access or not. The reason I make that shift is that I think we're moving more and more to a real-time evaluation of things. And doing entitlements is part of it. There's a default access this thing may have. But even in the moment, anytime that's used, I want to track it. I want to audit it. I want to have an audit trail. And I want to make a policy-based decision on whether or not they have access. And I may have made that already beforehand, but there'd be an additional check in closer to real time, I would think.
But we live in a very flawed world when it comes to policies. If we think about people who are middle-level managers, who've been with an organisation a decade or more, the chances are they've bounced through multiple departments. They have gained and soaked up accesses to systems that they've not needed for years, but we never take it away because we don't know why they had it. We don't know if they need it. If we're going to move to a real-time world, it offers the opportunity to be much more granular and much more restrictive to remove that area that can be exploited. But how do we gather that information? How do we build our view of somebody? Because we can't take a snapshot today. We can't take a snapshot over a week. We need a longer-term snapshot, but we need to see everything they touch before we start to remove stuff.
Two thoughts, at least. The removal aspect, if you have someone, an individual in your organization who has had multiple roles, and those roles are different than each other, and you have not removed previous access, you have failed your organization. In that case, that's a major flaw in an approach. Now, that may have happened.
But I come back and say that if I went out there today and we picked 100 banks in the City of London, we could probably find exactly that in 100 banks in the City of London.
I'm not sure. Ideally, you would not find it in every bank. It may be possible, but that's the whole idea of these systems. Multiple layers of access, so that if I change jobs, I'd better remove previous access and give the right access in place.
But we leave it there for a period of time during the job handover, because, of course, there'll be that handover. How many people have policies and processes that actually diarize? We've given them 3 months, we'll now remove it. The problem is time is your enemy here. You forget.
But the idea is you want to automate those processes so you're not relying on a human. You say you have access to this function for this period of time, and then it disappears. To answer the other part of your question, the whole baselining, yes, I think that usage is going to be a key area here. In other words, if I have access to some application, and then I don't use it for 6 months or 4 months, I have an obligation as an overseer to take that access away. All I'm doing is increasing the attack surface for my organization. So you're going to have a baseline over time of what they've done. More importantly, to take away access that's not being used, it's important to have that baseline to see what's normal or not. If I'm suddenly in Tokyo, classic example, I live in Texas, so that would be unusual. The first couple of times, it should flag me and say, Mike, you need to prove you're actually who you are in some way. Blood sample, DNA test, something significant. But after I meet that, you let me in. And after two or three rounds of that, now the policy should alter to say, oh, Mike now lives in Tokyo, as far as we know. All that process needs to be automated within certain parameters so that you don't have humans having to go in and edit policy and do that. Because, as you mentioned, speed and scale is going to be horrific going forward. Just the volume of identities, the volume of accesses, and all of that.
We're living in a world where company structures are becoming fluid. I'm old enough to know people who left school, got a job, and then retired from that job, or retired from that organization. Today, organizations come and go. Departments are created and lost almost as fast as we change applications within an organization, as people try and be more reactive to the commercial environment. Our workforce is more mobile, more fluid. So how do we make this adaptive enough to deal with those multiple levels of fluidity?
I would say that our work world and the roles within organizations is like positionless football. Whereas before, you stay on this part of the pitch. Now you can play multiple roles very, very quickly, to say nothing of interacting with the same organization in different roles. Much like the volume of identities is increasing, that agility has to increase as well. The only way to keep up with that is to automate the policy evolution of how you approach that. Now, I'm going to say a couple words that I really hate to say because it's just a triggering kind of thing, but I think that AI and machine learning have a role to play here. AI and ML is necessary to be able to keep up with how the policy dynamically evolves over time. Even as I say AI and ML is a good option, I want to be very clear that it has to be done in practical ways that make sense to the business and that, more importantly, are transparent and explainable. The reasoning behind how the system is making these decisions and implementing this policy, If we are to safeguard privacy that I talked about before, how we use identity and standards and practically, and just using the stuff ethically. I'm very focused on the ethical approach in using these algorithms. I think it's necessary. I think we just need to be wise about how we do it.
Processes are an interesting thing. If we think about business processes, they were things that were set in stone. They never evolved at the rate the business, software, and everything changed. What we've learned in the last decade is with the way we develop with low-code, no-code, we need to now have business processes that are built from the software as we write the software. If we start to talk about fluidity in roles and access and having processes that track and work with this, can we actually codify processes across an organization that are flexible and fluid enough to deal with that, or do we need a new way of what we perceive to be a process?
Most organizations usually don't have a clear understanding of their processes and their policy. Almost invariably, I walk into an organization, I say, how are you using identity? What does this look like? And they look around, and they have to go talk to 15 people, and they go, oh, that's how we're doing it. Fascinating. Then they have to decide if that's right or not. To more directly answer your question, though, we can do things. I'm not sure we're going to codify it in that way, but we can establish policy. And the reason is because humans think in policy by default. If you have a child and you take him to the street, you say, don't run into the street, and you expect the child, next time he comes or she comes to a street, they don't run. You've established a policy. What you don't say is, don't run in that street, or this street, or the A3 down there. The idea is that we inherently think in policy. Changing that from policy and how we think to something that's codified, it's not something we would write down. You'd also have to automate that kind of translation. Much like translating between English and German, for instance. You would use some facility to translate between how people express policy in normal spoken language or normal written language into something that would be more formally expressed. That's another thing that might be achievable with this generative AI wave, which is massively overhyped. But the idea of translating between, I would say, semantic bases. Anyone in this job function should have access to this, assuming they come from a known device and authenticated with some biometric, for example, as an expression of a policy. Translating that down to something that is usable by a automated computer system, there's a role to play for LLMs in that as well.
But now you're applying a contextual requirement to this. One of our major challenges when we get to AI, ML, Gen AI, LLMs, is this problem of establishing context. If we were to take written documents, we can often build a context from just a few pages. When we start to talk about usage of computer systems in the way somebody does their job and access to applications, that context is not just about a body, a seat, a keyboard, and an application. It's far more complex than that, and it's far more fluid than that. So how do we become contextually fluid?
Say more about that.
So my context will change based on where I am. It will change on what I'm doing. If I'm going to have an automated system that is going to use context to understand what I'm doing and decide should I or should I not do this thing, how do I build that awareness into the system of the fact that context is not something I can feed it through an LLM or feed it through some form of data? It needs to learn context.
Now, the LLM example, to be clear, is not making the decision. All the LLM is doing is translating human normal expression into something computer-based. 2006, we talked about doing security policy as an industry, and it died in a dumpster fire. Why? Because they said, oh, we'll make everything Xacimal. Everyone can speak Xacimal, and we'll translate to every application. No one knew how to do that. No one wanted to do that. And so it all died on the vine. All the major vendors tried it. We're at a similar crossroads now. But with LLMs, now we have a translation tool. I can speak Romanian with someone who speaks Romanian, and I can use English, and they can use Romanian, and the LLM is going to translate. The LLM is not thinking about truth or context. It's just doing straight translation. That's that part of the equation. Now, context, you're right. Every situation is going to be contextual. There may be extenuating circumstances in any access decision that's being made that are contextually based. Some of that you can express through policy. like I did already, location or authentication level on general broad parameters. There will be cases that can't be covered by any policy, no matter how flexible it is. We may have to do a callback. To extend my analogy earlier from the street, there are a couple things I want to know. If my kid goes into the street and I'm not there, I want my neighbor to rat out my child and say, he was in the street, because then I can go back and enforce the policy. Same thing applies in identity. I want events to come back up. But to your question, there may be times when the context makes things unclear. For example, we're on a rural road in Spain, and I'm with my child. My child says, we can't go in the street, but there are no cars. There's thorns and brambles on the side of the road. Can we walk down the street if I'm holding your hand and it's the middle of the day and there's no cars around? And I say, yes, yes, we can do that. There's a review of the context. There's got to be some facility for additional checks. Ultimately, there will always be edge cases that you need additional guidance by. And the key there is having both systems learn from each other, both humans and machines, in a virtuous loop where the machines learn from context and know how to evaluate the policy and modify the policy to fit more and more situations, and they hit edge cases and they say, human, what do you think? The human learning feeds into the machine learning, but also if it's an automated system, then the humans can see the policy that the machine learning is producing, and the humans learn, oh, there are new patterns that I didn't see before of access or context or whatever else. They both need to feed each other in the long term.
Well, you mentioned explainability. One of the challenges of explainability is that when we allow these systems to make these decisions, they're not making it off of one or two pieces of information that they can easily surface. They make it off of dozens and dozens of pieces of information. They themselves choose what to weight in that information. We have regulators who want explainability. How do we make transparent explainability in such a way that I can truly understand how you got to that, even though you haven't shown me all 65 different variables that you used?
There's a short answer and a more complicated answer. The shorter answer is it's difficult, but there's a whole field of research that is emerging around transparency and explainability. There are about 8 to 10 open source tools. AI Fairness 360 from IBM is pretty great. Aquitas is another one. Those are all discriminative models. In other words, it's classifying groups of data and saying, here's a boundary line. This is a dog, this is a cat, this should be allowed, this should not. And that helps explain why the model has made the delineation it has in the data or whatever else. That can be pretty helpful. Aquitas bears special mention because what it does is it puts out more raw data, but then it also gives long-form answers and responses that can inform people, made this choice, here's why, here's what you need to know, this is why it matters, this is why it is fair or unfair. Generative AI is another part of the equation which is much more difficult to find out and to transparently explain, because instead of saying, yes, this piece of data falls in class A or class B, now it's going to produce some new data. Good luck with that. But finding bias and finding echoes of injustice or unfairness in the objects that these generative models produce is yet another, even newer part of the equation that people are trying to hunt down, which is fascinating.
Bias. I'm glad you brought that word in here. One of the big challenges we have with bias is it is inherent in everything we do. When we think about our identity systems, we assume that they will be unbiased, that they will be fair, but they won't be. They will be affected by what we see in different countries, in different departments. They will be affected by the types of applications that people are using. If we're going to go down this route of greater automation, how do we identify and remove that bias? And let's be clear, everybody thinks bias is something just brought in by the computer systems. The biases we see from computer systems are minor compared to people's bias.
I think you're nailing it. The bias inherent in these AI ML systems are coming from their learning base, which is us. It's basically more like a mirror than a created bias in most cases. That can come from the original data, that can come from flaws in the algorithm or the way it underwent supervised learning or whatever else it is. identifying it, like I said, those tools help. There are a number of approaches. IEEE has an approach to how to detect and how to evaluate fairness in a very practical way. I had a paper written for a German journal that I outlined different practical elements you can do, like an ethics canvas, identifying and defining what harm is, who might be harmed if you adopt this technology, what the ramifications and effects are on them. That helps a business understand how we're using it, in addition to those tools that I mentioned before. What's really fascinating, though, is that with this new wave of generative AI and LLMs, what you in general see these days is people realizing that it was producing hateful speech or offensive art or whatever else. And what did they rush to do? They rushed to adjust the user rather than adjusting the model. They put restrictions on prompts. If you ask about these things, it won't respond. If you ask about these things, it say, I can't respond to that. I have no opinion. So instead of trying to adjust what the model produces, they're putting guardrails upon what you can request. I'm not sure that's the ideal approach. I'm not an expert in this space. I'm not qualified to say, well, they should do this. But that's a fascinating ethical conversation to be had. Do you fix the model and the data, or you just prevent people from asking inappropriate questions?
If you don't fix the model and the data, you don't fix the inherent bias.
That would be my take. It may or may not always be possible. There are elements of free speech in here somewhere. This would make its own riveting discussion and podcast as well. I have a theology degree, and so ethics is kind of my wheelhouse, especially where it meets society and implications for normal people, which identity always does.
One last question. We've got multiple different projects ongoing now as to what will be identity going forwards. And as we know in this industry, we always end up trying to fudge them together, or we end up with blocks of companies going different routes, all trying to create their own standards out of them. And it takes us decades to get to a viable solution. The problem is we don't have decades. We have wasted so much time. I remember the SCSI debacle well. Anybody who wants to research the fiasco that was SCSI 3 should go and see just how screwed over standards committees get. But when we think about identity, we need a better solution. We've got digital identities, we've got e-wallets coming up, different countries, even the EU producing its own. We've now got self-sovereign identity, decentralized identity, all sorts of phrases being used. Where do we go to harmonize this in some form of way, even if it's about the interoperability level, so that we end up with a functional solution and not in 10 years' time having the same discussion again about a new plan?
You can look at a recent example and see how things can work out. Look at passkeys. Whether you like them or not like them is irrelevant. I'm a fan. But the fact that all major vendors, most major vendors, adopted and got behind it gives it phenomenal power. It's great because it makes things, in general, objectively more easy for the end user. That's an ideal approach. As you point out, though, incentives don't always align. When it comes to digital identity, decentralized identity, there are a lot of things in play. How governments use these identities, what cultures, what significance they put on digital identity, what technological level you are in a country. There is an open paper by the OpenID that was put out this past year about government use of digital identity and how it's being developed. Fascinating read. I strongly suggest that if you're listening to this podcast, you go out and read it. It dips a little bit into the technology, but much more the cultural implications. What does harm mean in each country? What are the incentives? If you're in a developed country, your use case is going to be more ease of use and speed of accessing resources, because you presumably already have access to resources. If you're in a more developing country, then it's better health outcomes, access to financial resources, because you may not otherwise have that. I think it's a great case study, not just in government use of this kind of identity, but also the implications for enterprise and other organizations as well. I think enough people are interested in it working well in idealized ways. The reason I bring up the OpenID government ID paper is because I think government-issued identity is going to be a driving factor for a great number of people. It's one thing to have an employee-issued digital identity. That's ideal. But when it comes to voting and potential health care and other social services to be able to do these things with my government, that's a whole different thing. That's from an ethical higher level point of view. From a practical, the every person kind of experience, in terms of digital identity, the key is going to be air travel. In the developed world, if you go and take a flight, you go and show your physical ID, at least in the States, and that's all you need. You don't even need to show a boarding pass. With the advent of digital identity, there's going to be even more incentive to just be able to show a QR code from your phone that proves your identity and you walk right through. That ease of use, that ease of accessing something, being guarded, and then accessing it easily is going to be the gateway drug for a lot of people, because they're going to say, well, ease of use is my motivation, not even these other factors, because I don't have to wait in line. Getting them used to that flow of the exchange of identity through QR codes and the phone-based identity, that's going to pave the way for further adoption. No one's going to say, what is this new flow of? No, it's just like the airport. Scan and you're on your way.
Identity and user experience. Now, there's something that could take us on for another 10 hours.
Yes. Yes, it could.
But we're out of time. Mike, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.